Welcome to Build the Invisible, a podcast hosted by me, Daniel G, where we explore career journeys of today's most successful professionals. Each week, we sit down with guests to discuss the challenges they faced and the lessons that they've learned along the way, from dealing with failure to the importance of being patient and listening to others. We uncover the strategies and mindset that have helped our guests build successful careers. Join us as we delve into the stories of those who have persevered and achieved greatness in their fields. I had the pleasure of speaking with Dan Friedman, author of the iconic Jamie Johnson football books and CBBC series, and we covered the importance of experience, proactivity, and rejection. Dan is best known for his hugely successful Jamie Johnson books and TV series. The books have been adapted for TV by the BBC, and the drama series is broadcast worldwide. Before becoming an author, Dan was managing editor for the FA for 7 years. When not writing, Dan gives talks at schools and sports clubs. He has made over 2,000 school visits during the last decade, and it was those experiences that inspired him to write his newest novels, Unstoppable and I Am Lenny Brown. I hope you enjoy the chat.
Since actually we've probably got more friendly over the last 6 months or 9 months or so, since obviously everything has sort of happened, I've really enjoyed all of our conversations and some of our brainstorming sessions on a variety of different topics. And a lot of the time, and I think you'll appreciate it in the same way, which is part of the reason why Build Invisible has sort of taken shape a bit, is because lots of people will say to me, "Oh, how did you become a football lawyer?" Just maybe in the same way that people say to you, "How did you become a football writer or an author?" In the same way that I know people will say to people in the music industry or fashion industry or jewelry business or TV and film, you know, "That's my passion. How do I combine that passion and curiosity with my day job?" So from being in the presence of a best-selling sports and football author, how firstly did you think about whether it was writing first or whether it was your passion football idea first, and how did you then start on that journey?
Well, it went way back to being a kid, really, in that my passion was football, and obviously I wanted to be a footballer but wasn't good enough. And so then it was literally the first question when I was about 13 or 14 was, how on earth am I going to get involved with football? Because I just was really stubborn and didn't like doing anything that I didn't want to do. And the only thing I wanted to do and think about was my passion, which was football. And so at the time, I didn't really consider myself much of a reader, because the books we were being told to read at school didn't really engage me. And therefore, I wasn't much of a writer. But the first inkling of writing and getting involved with football was the idea that football journalists got to go to watch football and meet the players as part of their job. So they got paid to do it. And that was a revelation, really. And so then the first action behind that idea was I wrote to every single football club, radio station, TV station, newspaper in my area. I guess I was lucky that I lived in London, but you know, there are obviously those organizations in every area, and said, "Can I please come in and make the teas and coffees and do the photocopying during my school holidays?" And you've got to utilize, obviously, if you know someone who works at an organization. I knew someone who knew someone who worked at a football club and did some work there. And then the other thing I found was that people will open their doors, generally speaking, to allow you to come in and do some work experience quite often. And then it's up to you to make yourself as invaluable or as useful as possible, because it can work the other way. I've also seen it be the case and felt it be the case that sometimes work experience people are a bit of a hassle to have around, because you've got to think of something for them to do. So there's a balance. I was at the Mail on Sunday doing work experience, and I kept going into the editor's office and leaving him notes for articles that I thought should be written, and even writing an article and giving it to him. And at some point he called me and he said, look, you know, you see all those people out there, they're the journalists that I pay to do this work. This article's fine, but you know, you're not one of my journalists. I was like, okay. But then, you know, because I had shown willing, he came out again another week later. He said, do you want to get your name in this newspaper or what? I said, yeah. He said, okay, well, there's this simple little article that needs to be written. You know, it's your job to go and do it. And it was basically about saying what clubs were doing for fans, which turned on its head the idea that clubs were always trying to take money from fans. A very simple idea. But it stemmed from trying to make myself useful and trying to get that little bit of opportunity and recognition. So I guess there's those stages. There's getting your foot in the door, and then there's being people knowing who you are and what you can do and trying to make yourself a positive asset in that workplace. And the other thing I would suggest, and that I always asked for, every time I left an organization, if I had, as I hoped I had, been helpful, I would always go to someone and say, could I please get just a little reference, just a paragraph or two on headed paper? So by the end of my time at school and uni, I had these references from the BBC, Sky, ITV, The Mail on Sunday, Daily Express, Arsenal Football Club. And I hadn't done anything mind-blowing there, but it really made me look a much more authentically credible person to maybe get an opportunity in that industry that I loved, because I had these references from these organizations. And what I always thought was, loads of people would want the job that I was aspiring to have, to be paid to be working football and watching football. But that's no good to just say I want to do it. You've got to back it up with action. So I'd backed it up with action. I tried to make myself useful. And then I had evidence in the words of people in the industry saying that I had been useful. So I was like 20, 21. And I hadn't worked officially in the industry, but I had this CV, so that when I did apply for a job, it didn't look like I was just coming out of nowhere. It looked like this is something I'd been building towards for many years, which had been the case.
Can I ask them one a number of interesting little subplots of that? Because one of the things in the book that I'm very, very strong on, and we've talked about quite a few times, is how it's really important that if you want a favor from somebody, but when you're doing the proactive thing, which is a fantastic thing to do, and go and saying to them, can I have work experience? Can I do that? I believe that in a way, the best thing that you can try and create in the reaction from the other person when you're looking for them to do you a favor is simply the words yes. How best to get to yes. And I think you said it exactly right when you said, just let me come in and make the teas and coffees and any of the stuff that needs to be done. Because I think a lot of people think when they want a job or they want that work experience, it has to be, please let me come in and be the center of the universe, not center of the universe in that sense, but in terms of, I need to do substantive stuff. I need to do all of this great things to put on my CV to justify my existence. Whereas actually, and it goes to the point of my question in a roundabout way, I'm sure you learn really interesting sets of skills and soft skills from just being in that work environment and seeing and feeling and doing all of the things that people do in their normal jobs.
Massively. I think in a way, it's almost like, you know, people are nervous about going to a new school. Obviously, you're going to be nervous when you finally get into a workplace. But if you've had the opportunity just to be in there before and just cast your eye around, you know what you're going into. And I think that sometimes all you're looking for in a work experience opportunity is literally someone just say, thanks for that cup of tea, what's your name? You know, so that they acknowledge your existence, because that's where you've got to begin from. And yeah, in with the newspapers, that's where I started from, the editor saying, you know, we're not interested in this. Then he said, do you want to get your name in the newspaper? And then when I left, he said, well, what are you expected to get in your A-levels? Do you want to come and work here after you finish your A-levels? So it really, really is slowly, slowly, as you say, getting your foot through the door by giving them the best chance to say yes. And that then continues in the rest of your career, I find. I started working at the FA. Again, this was a paid job, but answering the phones, answering letters and emails. And I wanted to progress. And I got a great bit of advice from someone who'd been in the department. I was working in the communications department, someone who'd been in there longer than me. She said, look, our boss, what you need to do for him is write down the job spec that you want to do. You know, what's it called? What are your responsibilities? How will it improve the working of the office and the organization? Why, you know, why you're the right person to do it? Because he's not, you know, she just said it realistically, he's not going to be thinking about your development necessarily. But if you can go in, show him what your development like to be, and all he has to do is say yes, then that's how you do it. And that's why it's good that you're doing this book, because you wouldn't necessarily know that unless you've been in the circumstances that, yeah, you've got to give people the answer or the opportunity to give you the answer that you want.
And I totally agree. It's almost like you don't know until you know. And I almost think that some of the things that I know now, if my younger self would have known, would have probably saved me quite a lot of hassle, is the truth, and sometimes disappointment. Not that there's anything wrong with all of those things, because that in itself is very much the learning curve. But I think in effect, that journey becomes very important. So if we can take that journey from FA into, which obviously takes a number of years, into then your role as being a writer, a full-time writer, how did that happen? And because that couldn't have been an easy path in a way, from deciding to leave such a great organization at the FA to do stuff on your own. You know, that takes quite a lot of strength of character to go from a paid job to I'm going to do something very different and put myself out there at a time when, you know, like, I guess the stereotypical thing is always get the paid job, get a salary, you know, all of the structured stuff that you come to expect from jobs these days, rather than the risk of everything else.
Yeah. I was so, so happy in my first few years at the FA, and so proud to work at that organization at the center of the sport that I loved. And then unfortunately things changed, and chief executives changed, and the culture became, I found, very much more defensive and staid and less proactive, less positive. And I knew that I didn't fit there anymore, because I wanted to move forward and do fresh, innovative things. And I just felt that wasn't what was on people's agendas at that time. So the easiest thing would have been to sort of throw my toys out the pram and leave and go and do anything other than that, because I wasn't happy anymore working there. But I had a really good piece of advice from someone who I worked alongside. I opened up a bit and explained my situation. And he said to me, you only get to leave once. Make sure you do it right. And that presented a kind of image in my head of that I was standing on a platform, which I had done, you know, I was very proud of myself to have got a job in that organization, however I felt about it at that time. I was standing on that platform, and I guess there were three options. I could either leave, four options. I could either stay and it would be very flat. I could leave and go down, which would be probably if I threw my toys out of the pram and went to somewhere that I wasn't particularly, you know, enamored with. I could leave and go somewhere equivalent, or I could leave and go up. But there weren't that many opportunities, I didn't think, to leave and go up, because it was still a dream job. Even if I wasn't particularly happy, I was still at the center of football. So I decided that no matter how difficult it was, I was going to stick it out until and I wasn't going to leave unless it was something that in my mind was definitively better, absolutely better than where I was. Then what happened was I became aware, this was just at the time that Harry Potter was getting massive, and someone told me that they'd gone to a bookshop to buy a novel for a football mad kid, 10, 11 year old football mad kid, but they hadn't found any football novels in there. They're autobiographies and biographies and short stories, but not proper, proper novels with football in there. And effectively what happened for the next 3 years or so was I thought about the film Shawshank Redemption, in that I would go to work and I would do my job, but I would also save a little bit of myself while I was at work. I would save a little bit of my energy, my enthusiasm, my ideas, my positivity, my drive, because I knew that they weren't really being appreciated or put into action there. So I held them in reserve. And then I would come home each night, and the first thing I would do would be to go to sleep. I read about Winston Churchill and how he used to have, you know, a 10-minute power nap or 20-minute power nap after lunch during the war, which would allow him to keep going till 2 or 3 in the morning, and then be up again early the next morning. So, yeah, I would come home from work, I would go to sleep for a bit, have a little nap, and then I would work into the early hours trying to write a novel, which I'd never done before. My aspiration, my dream was to be the next J.K. Rowling, for my character, Jamie Johnson, to be the Harry Potter of soccer. And it gave me, yeah, that was my vision and my aim. And each day, each night, I considered it to be, you know, a little bit more carving away of the future I wanted for myself. And that went on and off for about 3 years, 3 years of rejections, 3 years of trying to make the book better, 3 years of staying in my job because of the pact I had made with myself of not leaving, until I got to a point where the book was good enough. I had an agent and I had a 3-book offer from a really big children's publisher called Scholastic. And at that point, I still thought that maybe I'd stay at the FA and maybe do it alongside them, but it just didn't work out. And I thought, right, if I want to make a success of this career of being an author, I need to give everything to it. And I had waited long enough that this book deal at least gave me a little bit of a buffer, a financial buffer, to take that risk that you're talking about. So I waited until I had another platform to go to. And in my mind, especially because of all the rejections and the difficulty of the path of getting that 3-book deal, I felt that that was the platform that was higher than the one I was on. And that was when I took the leap.
And I know I'm skirting around a little bit on some of my questions and timelines and otherwise, but just bear with me for a second, which is when you were going through that almost transition away from the FA and to what you're going to obviously do full time and being incredibly successful at doing it. Well, what was your mindset like at different times when you were thinking, I presume I've invested a lot of time, I put all these habits in place to try and draft, to try and put, to bring Jamie Johnson to life. I keep on getting all of these rejections. I keep on people telling me it's not good enough, or in effect, I'm not good enough, I guess, is the ultimate position. How did you cope with that? And how did you deal with it to gain enough resilience to keep going, even though I presume some people kept on rejecting you whilst others didn't necessarily know about you at that time?
The first rejection was brilliant. I sent my book to Bloomsbury, who were the publishers of Harry Potter, because that was the journey I was going to follow. And they're your publishers as well, aren't they?
They are.
Yeah. And I got a rejection. And it felt fantastic because I was like, because I'd never written a book before, and probably deep down I didn't believe, you know, although I had these huge stated ambitions, deep down you always have doubt. But there I was with a letter about my book from Bloomsbury Publishers on headed notepaper talking about my Jamie Johnson book. Okay, the book said, sorry, we're not interested. But that didn't matter. I was just on an absolute high, really, because suddenly it was real. Suddenly I was in the game. You know, they were, these publishers were talking about my book. So it existed. So then I was on a bit of a high, and then the stubbornness came back out in me, and I was like, right, now I'm in business, and now I've got a target, and that's to prove these people wrong. And it really gave me fire and fuel and determination. I had a very specific target. These people, they need to know that they've made a mistake. I'm going to work everything to the bone in order to make it good enough, and I'll show them. And I really found that very motivational. And so that early rejection, and it really gave me a lot of power. Then the next stage was really after about 18 months, 2 years of being rejected. I'd gone through some really good development. And what I found was I tried to make every rejection a positive, in that whenever I got rejected, I always wrote back and said, can you tell me why you're rejecting the book? Because I knew that I'd never had a novel published before, and I couldn't expect to just sit down and turn one out like that. And so some of the rejections were really constructive. I'll never forget, for example, that someone took the time to walk me through, and we discovered that I was making Jamie Johnson too nice of a character, because I thought, because I'm writing for kids, he should be some kind of role model. And I thought role model was flawlessness, and it's not. The best role models are the people that have got flaws that we all have, and then we can discuss it and talk about how we overcome them. And so this fantastic piece of advice from this editor, she was kind enough to talk to me, and she said, you've got to find that balance. He's got to dip his toe in the water. He's got to be naughty, but it can't get wet. And I was like, okay, I think that makes sense. So some of the rejections were absolutely pivotal for me. But still, after about 2 years, I had had enough of rejections and actually getting nowhere. And that's when I always, you know, say you do need, especially in schools, which I visit a lot, you know, we talk about growth mindset and resilience and perseverance. But the truth is I was ready to give up. And the truth is I called up a friend who had been really helpful to me. She'd once had a book published, and so she took it upon herself to be in my corner. And I called her up about 10 o'clock at night, and I said, I'm giving up. Thanks for all your help, but you know, I've given it 2 years and it hasn't worked. So be it. I need to move on and think about something else. And she said, she told me to shut up, told me I was an idiot, and told me to go and carry on with my writing and to call her back any time, day or night, when I'd finished. And she told me I was wrong and that the book was going to be published and I've got to get back on that horse. And I thank her in every book, in the acknowledgements of every book that I write. I always thank her because that conversation saved the career that I hadn't yet had and that I'm so proud to have. And so I do believe, not everyone has it, but if you've got someone in your corner that you can share the journey with. Sometimes we do need people to believe in us when we don't believe in ourselves. I think growth mindset, perseverance, resilience, is very important, and it's easy things to discuss. But I don't think people should be ashamed or afraid to sometimes admit that they feel like giving up, because I certainly did. And I think that's human nature too. You just hope you're lucky enough to have someone like I did, who didn't allow me to give up.
Totally agree. Totally agree. You almost need the, I'd say the mirror, if that's the right way of putting it, which is you innately believe you're good enough when you look at yourself in the mirror, but sometimes you need someone else to believe in your characteristics as well to give you that strength on occasion.
Yeah, and I just think we need it, don't we? We need that arm around the shoulder, metaphorically, just someone to say, keep going.
Hello, and welcome back to Build the Invisible with me, Daniel G. In addition to sharing insights and lessons on career success, I'm also the founder of a charity fashion brand called 13. At 13shop.co.uk, you can order hoodies, t-shirts and socks, with all proceeds going towards cancer research. So not only can you evaluate your personal and professional development with the insights shared on this podcast, but you can also support a great cause with your purchase from 13. Visit 13shop.co.uk today to browse our collection and make a difference. Thank you for supporting Build the Invisible and the mission of 13.
Agreed. Can I ask you then the next one, because you put a really great piece of content out on social media, I think around a month or so ago, was a video which I loved, which almost demystified your writing to a degree. And the reason why I loved it so much was that here you are, this fantastic multi-million selling book author. I think that's right, maybe. It feels like it should. It is. And here you are putting out a paragraph of writing. I'm not sure if it was about the Jamie Johnson or another book, but in any event, with just lots and lots of scribble on it. I think part was your scribble and part was an editor's scribble, demonstrating effectively that your first iteration of something is certainly not the last iteration of something. Yes, please share it. Here we are. And the reason why I love it so much is because everybody has this glossy image of all of these writers doing everything and perfectly first time. Whereas actually it's the exact opposite of that by the sounds of it. I can speak from my experience. It's just iteration on iteration, compounding on compounding on compounding in order to get you to the end result. And I just love just to hear about sort of why you put that out there and almost the sort of life lesson behind it, perhaps.
Yeah, and the first thing that was a revelation to me that I learned when I was at school, when I was doing A-levels, actually, I can remember I always found myself feeling so alone when we were given a piece of work, writing to do. And I remember one day, it wasn't even my teacher, but I was talking to this person, this other teacher, and he said to me, well, you know, tell me what you're thinking of writing and we can discuss it before you start writing it. And it was amazing to think that there was a B between A and C, and that you were allowed to go and talk to someone about what you were going to do before you did it, rather than just you get given a task and then you hand in the task and then you get told whether it was right or wrong. It sort of felt so good that it felt like cheating to me. And that was an amazing thing to do. And I do that whenever I can now. If I've got a task and I'm doing it for someone, especially if I'm obviously doing a book, I'll talk to my editor and say, look, these are my ideas. What do you think of them? Not only does it help you get on the right track, but of course it's quite clever in the sense that if you're delivering it for someone and you've had a chat with them beforehand and you've discussed it, they kind of get ownership of it. So when you hand it in, they want it to be good because they've given you some of the ideas. So that for me was one of the biggest parts of learning how to write, was talk to someone about what you're going to do before you do it. And then to come back to this example of writing. Yeah, this is what being a writer is. That's what I always say in schools. Being a writer, any of us can write a book or write a story, but this is what being an actual author looks like, because the most significant part of the work is not sitting down and writing a story or writing an article or writing a piece of work. The most significant effort is, once you've got something there, having a look at how to make it the best it can be. So in this scenario, as you said, I'd written 7 lines in a Jamie Johnson book, handed it in to my editor, and then we both had a look at it to see if there's anything that could be improved. And that's the question, you know, you ask yourself, how can this be better? And her writing is the larger writing. She's saying maybe there should be more background about family history, for example. And then my writing is this scrawl that you can't really read, further ideas that I've had. And then essentially what you've got is the fact that we've decided that every single word is going to have to be changed. And that's 35 words of a novel, which might be 35,000 words. So that might be a thousandth of the work that goes into the book after it's written. But you might want to go do 10 drafts or so. So that might be 1/10,000th of the work that goes into the book after it's written. And that is what being an author is, different to someone who would like to write a book. And when you get this back and you look at it, a big part of you is stamping your feet on the ground saying, but I wanted it to be perfect. Why isn't it perfect? Why can't you just tell me that what I've done is brilliant and we move on? And then a little part of you, the adult part of you, the professional part of you, saying, well, this person's brain is now allied to my brain, and we're both chasing the same objective, which is to make this piece of work as good as it can be. So you should be grateful that this brain is helping you to make that objective a possibility by giving you the opportunities and the insight to improve what you're doing that's going to have your name on it and that's going to go all over the world. So it's just about trying to listen to that wise bit of you as opposed to the child in you that is stamping the feet on the ground saying, but I wanted it to be perfect first time round.
And exactly on that point, when we went for our customary walks over the last few months, you mentioned one thing to me about a piece of work, which was that you were writing it. I can't remember the exact phrase. You'll probably have the better phrase than I. You were writing it to getting it out there as a means to then improve it as a result. And that's the thing that I mentioned the book quite a lot. It's almost like the, not to coin a Nike phrase, but it's almost like the just doing. It's the starting of the creative process, whatever it might be. That really is the buzz that I still get, and I can totally see it. It's the buzz that you completely get. The act of, maybe it's just like the act of creation is the truth in our own small ways. That act of putting something out there, knowing it doesn't need to be perfect, which then can be iterated. That to me is a really powerful message.
Yeah, and there are so many different ways to think about it, but yeah, it's. Just get something that you can talk about and then you work on improve it. And there are millions of metaphors. One that I was just thinking about is probably rubbish, but like, you don't try and have a huge fire. You've just got to get some heat and get that first flame going. And then you can fan it and get it really going. But don't wait for perfection to come along in order to put it out there. Because that's the C. The B bit after A is to get something out there, which is generally rubbish and you know it, but at least it's something that you can talk about. And that's the way that you get to C from A, is by having that B. Does that make sense?
It does. There's the book that I was telling you about a little bit ago, Atomic Habits, by a guy called James Clear. And he talks a lot about, quite early on in the book, about the act of compounding. It's almost those small iterations, consistent small iterations that don't feel like they're making a difference in the short term, but over a longer consistent period of time, make that massive fire that you're talking about, make the novel. But what you need to start with is the small flame and the first iteration.
Just got to get something to talk to people about, because then those little iterations, as you say, it's actually really fun, and it's not too, it doesn't make you feel too apprehensive. You talk to someone, you say, oh, I'm just going to change that paragraph, I'm just going to add that bit, and you do that over time, and they're nice little bits to add and to change and to improve, and that's fun. But it can feel so overawing if you're sitting down and you're saying, now I've got to create brilliance, I've got to create perfection, because it doesn't happen. So yeah, just get a little bit something that you can hold in your hands and mold, and then enjoy that molding process rather than attempting to extract from yourself the final product at the beginning?
Because presumably, and I'm starting to change my view on the word passion, as in when everyone says to me, I'm really passionate about music, or again, all these different passion industries that we talk about, is after I read a piece, a VC tech starter guy, entrepreneur called Paul Graham, and he, I'll send you the link, so it was really fascinating. He talked about the idea, not necessarily of passion, but of curiosity being your driver. Is that, sorry, go on. Yeah, no, I don't.
And also you said to me once about finding something that you don't mind doing.
Yeah.
You know, and so I guess these are all different expressions of things that we are able to do and able to give our time to. And if we're curious about something, then it doesn't feel difficult, or it doesn't feel too much of a hardship to invest our time in. And if we're just doing tiny little improvements, that is bite-sized bits of fun.
The way that I realize that I'm curious about something is when I sit down to read or do or consume or whatever, and I just give myself a 5-minute thing just to write, I'm going to do that, and it turns into half an hour. And you don't realize it's turned into half an hour, because even though the initial act might have been energy sapping, I'm going to have to do this now, I want to do this now, once you actually get into it, and when people say time flies, I'm fascinated by the idea of time flying is the truth, because I think that is the output of curiosity.
Yeah, I agree.
Another thing that I just want to mention, I'm sorry we're going on for a while, but it's because you've got a lot of pearls of wisdom right now and I don't want to stop your flow, which is habit forming stuff. So again, with James Clear or with others, and we talked about those small incremental changes and iterations and compounding. You talk, for example, about how when you're at the FA still, you'd come back, you'd have a sleep. I presume that's almost like a refresh, a sort of separation, like, right, now I can properly focus, and that's the time to do into the early hours. Do you find that you still have quite a lot of those types of productive habits, things that you do, stuff generally that is of value to you professionally or just in your life more generally?
I'm maybe not the best example in this, because what happens if I am in on a writing project, if I feel like I'm in the zone, basically everything else goes out the window.
Yep.
And sometimes I will specifically take myself away to a different place where my family and friends and phone and laptop, you know, apart from what I'm using to write, aren't present. Because I do find it difficult to find absolute clarity of thought in and around all of the normal things that we need to do, whether it's the washing up or answering emails or going on Twitter or whatever it may be. I find that saps my focus and creativity. Really, for me to be creative, I want nothing apart from a book that I'm reading to grow my mind and to get me feeling. So that is one thing, actually. When I'm writing, I always, always read a book, because it's like the equivalent of, if you want to speak French well, you surround yourself with good French speakers. So I find that if I'm reading a good book, it's not that I'm copying it, it's just that I'm speaking the language of excellent literature in my mind. And so I, you know, just something will give me a little booster and it will connect with what I'm looking to produce in my story. And then I'll get up and I'll go and write. So for me, when I'm writing, if I'm really in the zone, it's like my antenna are up and everything that I'm thinking or reading is dedicated to that one goal of deepening and improving the story and examining it more. So it's not necessarily very well matched with real life and obligations and responsibilities.
No, well, I can understand that completely. Holly, my wife, when I was talking about starting to write this in the first place, I said, you know, I think I just need a few undistracted days. So I booked into a hotel not ridiculously far away from where I am, only about an hour or so away. just to get into that habit routine of exactly what you said, just nothing else distracting apart from my laptop. And going and doing for 10, 12 hours a day, which I really enjoyed and was very empowering. But what I found there was is that I, even within that period, I had certain times when I was more engaged or proactive. So for example, for me, I'm better from 7 a.m., 7:15 until around lunchtime. I know I'm not brilliant from about 3 till 5. And I know I'm very good late at night from 8 till 11, say for example. Even within what you're saying in terms of either thinking time, doing time, reading time or otherwise, do you have particular periods? Because there's a whole set of literature on this in terms of when you feel that you're at your peak in terms of you, if you're a footballer or otherwise, or a sort of artist generally.
I think I'm quite sensitive around sleep. So it depends if I've had a good night's sleep. But yeah. What I find is... it depends. Also, it goes around if I've had exercise, I find that very helpful. But what I was going to say was sometimes my best work is when I've allowed myself to switch off and so I'm not working. So maybe I've done a good day's work of writing and editing, and then I'll be watching a film and it'll be midnight and my brain is relaxed and I'll say, that is brilliant. The idea of that character in the film, you know, suddenly changing their mind because they've seen the bus stop and they've seen the expression on the faces of the people at the bus stop and it's made something click in their mind. That relates directly to the dilemma of my character. And I'll just, you know, make a note, you know, obviously, so I always have to write it down at the time. And that one clarity of thought, piece of clear thought, when I thought I'd knocked off for the day at midnight, will probably set me up for the whole day's writing the next day, which could come at any time with me, to be honest. It just depends. I'm constantly playing games with myself to try and get myself feeling confident enough to put pen to paper. But I definitely find that it's often when I switch off that I'm most productive or creative. Sometimes you'll wake up, and I know Keith Richards has talked about this, you'll wake up with a brilliant idea, you write it down, or at least you think it's a brilliant idea, and then you wake up the next morning and it literally doesn't even make sense. Keith Richards' case, one day he woke up and he didn't even remember it, but on his little dictaphone, he had the riff for Satisfaction, I think it was, and he didn't even remember recording it. And of course, we're talking about all this perseverance and stuff. There are the outliers as well. I think famously, if I'm not wrong, Elton John, who I think Sheridan's do some work with, I think famously his diary entry was something like, did this in the morning, went to meet someone else in the evening, in the afternoon wrote Candle in the Wind. Like, you know. but of course, it's... sometimes what seems like a moment of inspiration is actually the crystallization of years of thought, you know, an analysis that then just presents itself sometimes.
I think on things like that, I could be completely wrong, but I think that is the compounding effect. Candle in the Wind is the compounding effect of the 20 years worth of writing that has gone before to get him into that place. Maybe other things as well included, but yeah.
And the book that I'm working on at the moment, which you and Holly are reading and kindly helping me with it, I've been trying to write it probably for 6 or 7 years, but I didn't find the hook. And then I was walking near where you and I live. I was walking on the heath and I wasn't even, you know, barely thinking about it. And then I was just like, what if the character can't do this? Then that's something definitive that they can't do. And that means that that's an obstacle for them to overcome. And I don't know, we'll see whether anything happens with this book. But if it does, it will be because of that one moment, just having a walk, not even really thinking about things and an idea coming to you. But it's because the brain has been working on it for 6 or 7 years.
I think also the benefit of, when I've spoken to other people as well, the benefit of... having that clarity of thought. I think a lot of the time that clarity of thought is because you're doing something else at the same time, out of the thing that you're doing, the ability actually to connect disparate ideas is what I think sets a lot of people apart. It's the clarity of thought to know, oh, I read, I spoke, I thought, I did something completely different, whilst that cog for the big thing that you're doing is very, very slowly just ticking over like that. And then suddenly that one thing goes like that and it goes click.
That's
not sure how you find it that sometimes.
That's exactly it. It's looking for connections. And yeah, me personally, when I'm on, I can see connections in everything to what I'm doing. Literally just looking at a pamphlet and I'll say that color is what, you know, is my character's favorite color. Or I'll look at a sculpture and I'll say the expression on that face is how that character feels. Everything, when I'm really on song, everything is flowing into the idea, and I can use everything.
Very cool. Last one. I think you've probably already touched on it anyway. And this isn't to put you on the spot, but the last question I ask everybody that I'm chatting to is, if you had a massive billboard where you could say anything to inspire others, what would it say?
Mistakes are brilliant. Just don't make the same mistakes twice.
Love it. Well, that was quick.
Well, I think that's, you know, and you have to keep telling that to yourself, and that, you know, it's easy to say, but you know, because we don't want to make mistakes, we don't want to do something wrong or be embarrassed. But yeah, I think mistakes are, certainly that's what I would say to my younger self, is make as many mistakes as you can, because that's how we grow and how we learn. But if you make the same mistakes, then that's stupid.
Yeah, there's the bit in a saying, a Japanese saying that I love, that you've probably heard it as well. I'm going to try and pronounce it right because I've got my notes next to me, but I could make it complete pig's ear of it, so apologies. It says, it's Nana Kurobi Ya Oki, I think, or Ya Okai, which means fall 7, rise 8.
Yeah.
Which I really like. I'm always interested in 7 and 8 because it's not 1 or 2, or it's not 0 or 1. It's, you're going to keep falling in a positive way, but you're going to keep up. But,
and what I don't understand about that is, why isn't it fall 7, rise 7? Because how can you rise 8 times if you've only fallen 7? Or have I got that wrong?
Well, I think if you fall 7 times, then aren't you right? And you're rising 7.
Then you're, so on,
you're
your
saying, are you saying you fall first and then you rise? Yes, interesting.
Yeah, after the 7th rise, if you don't fall again, that's, you're there, you're standing.
Maybe you're rising higher.
Yeah. So you got 2 rises on the end.
It would seem a bit odd, wouldn't it? Fall 7, rise 7.
Yeah, exactly. But it's got to be accurate. But who am I to argue with centuries of Japanese?
You really messed my head up with that. I'm going to have to really think about that now.
Yeah? You rise up. How do you rise up for the 8th time if you've only fallen 7?
But maybe, Dan, maybe you're rising first.
Rising first. But then wouldn't you say rise 8, fall, you know, like if rising is first, wouldn't it come first in the slogan?
Well, I think the emphasis is obviously on the positive. So it would sound a bit worse, rise 8 but fall 7.
Yeah, exactly. It depends if you consider yourself to be upstanding. Yeah, because we're not born, I don't know. Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
Dan, thanks very much for that. And yeah, I'm sorry to take, we were going to talk for half an hour, we'll talk for an hour.
Do more anytime, you know. That's, let's consider that the first iteration, and then when we want to do more, we can do more.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Build the Invisible with me, Daniel G. We hope you've enjoyed today's conversation and took away some valuable insights and lessons. If you'd like to learn more about the strategies and mindset discussed on the show, be sure to check out the book, my book, Build the Invisible, and the accompanying BTI journal, both available at www.buildtheinvisible.com. We also encourage you to leave us a review and subscribe to keep up to date on future episodes. Thanks for listening.